Support for WMFE comes from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University's worldwide campus, where highly ranked online degree programs offer the flexibility to learn what students want from wherever they are. More at erau.edu/worldwide.
In Central Florida, Puerto Ricans now make up a significant part of the population, and the cultural impact is more visible today.
There's been an exodus of people from Puerto Rico, and the landing spot has been right here in Central Florida. They're concentrated along the I-4 corridor and then down to the I-95 corridor.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. Our region is home to one of the largest concentrations of Puerto Ricans in the country. About 1.3 million Puerto Ricans live in the state, and roughly 500,000 call Central Florida home. On Super Bowl Sunday, a global star, Puerto Rican artist Bad Bunny, thrusted that culture into the spotlight. Numbers show it's the most viewed halftime show ever. Millions watched from home or went to watch parties. At La Vergenza, Puerto Rican, Chinchorro, in Orlando Square, the crowd was packed, singing and dancing together.
We came to celebrate and watch the game.
The Super Bowl, and I see Bad Bunny.
It's not just person that cares about the community, but he's a legend for us.
It is really big for us, so he just had a whole concert in Puerto Rico that put us kind of more on the map because a lot of people didn't understand that we are U.S. citizens. So I think it's more like orgullo, how do you say, like a pride that we're like representing for Puerto Rico.
Not everyone watched in the same way. Over at Made in Puerto Rico Lake Mary Social, every seat is full at the new restaurant that just opened 3 weeks ago, where Antonio Roman is the manager on duty.
We felt like Lake Mary needed, you know, a Latin place that was authentic to Puerto Ricans. And this is what we got. You know, I have a packed house tonight, and, you know, probably nothing but Puerto Ricans in here.
They're here for the Benito Bowl watch party event. Benito is Bad Bunny's real name. I stopped by to explore why this moment matters so much to the community. Bruni Garcia is sitting at the bar with her two sisters, Damaris Beltran and Sarai Beltran.
What does it mean to see Bad Bunny perform on the biggest stage?
It's a remarkable thing to see because it's a part of our culture, and it just, so many doors are opening for our culture, and it's just exciting.
Do you ever notice Puerto Rican Spanish in his songs?
Yes.
What is it like to have that language reflected to a global audience?
It is a beautiful thing because he knows where he comes from and he's making that a part of his music.
It makes me feel excited and happy, and I mean,
that he's proud.
That he's proud.
And what's it like being here in a place called Made in Puerto Rico?
It makes me feel like I am in Puerto Rico today, celebrating him because he is from Puerto Rico.
I also met Michelle Baez over in the dining room. She's lived in Florida for about 12 years since moving from Puerto Rico.
The halftime show was amazing. I love watching it, and I love watching Bad Bunny, of course. It was the best thing ever. You know, we don't usually see a lot of us Puerto Ricans representing us and like something so big such as the Super Bowl. So that was once in a lifetime.
It's clear that moments like the halftime show mean so much to so many people here. To better understand why, we're joined by Fernando Rivera, a sociology professor and director of the Puerto Rico Research Hub at UCF.
People were already saying like, wow, a Puerto Rican artist is going to showcase Puerto Rican culture in one of the biggest stages in the world. So obviously for anybody, and picture yourself, whoever you are or where you come from, if you know somebody from the place that you know well and that you sort of associated with, to have that big of a platform, I think that was what a lot of people were looking for. And obviously he didn't disappoint in showing sort of the good, the bad, and the ugly about the Puerto Rican experience. I don't know if you paid close attention, but they were older dancers, younger dancers. There was a wedding. I mean, if you come from a Hispanic background, you have been forced to go to a wedding that you didn't want to attend, and you had to stay there for hours and hours. So that little kid sleeping on top of the chairs, I think it resonated with a lot of people. But at the end of the day, bringing this joy of how this culture is showcased and finally being seen and heard in a positive light for most of people.
What does it mean when a community sees itself reflected on a stage of that magnitude?
Oh, it brings an absolute pride. And the fact that it was done in Spanish, I think also was refreshing in a sense that, you know, we have had a lot of crossover artists. They were told like, hey, if you want to go to this market, you need to change certain things. And Bad Bunny has been unapologetic of saying like, hey, I'm going to do what I do. You know, sometimes when you come into a new place and you're trying to merge in, you know, you have to have this negotiation of aspects of your culture that you're going to leave behind and maybe the ones that you're going to pick up. And I think for the community, it was like, wow, look, this person can be himself, be part of that cultural pride without having to apologize of who he is. And I think that brought about a lot of pride for a lot of people.
Puerto Rico's relationship with the U.S. is different than that of a state. Does that show up in moments like what we saw at the Super Bowl?
Absolutely. The show was sort of a very quick rundown of contemporary history for Puerto Rico, right? It started in the sugar canes, right? Puerto Rico became a possession of the United States after the Hispanic-American War in 1898. A lot of agricultural products were brought into the island. Puerto Rico was mostly an agricultural place from the beginning of the 1900s all the way to the 1940s when there was this process of industrialization, right? When the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico came in. And there was this governmental experiment after World War II of urbanizing Puerto Rico, right? Of began, you know, making Puerto Rico this urban destination. And from sugar canes, all of a sudden you came into the urban setting that led to a lot of out-migration because they were trying to depopulate the island, and they landed in New York. And that was showcased in the halftime show when you had the little bodegas and you had the barber shop and you had the little corner store. Then there was kind of like this evolution out here that all of a sudden with what happened after Hurricane Maria, that you saw the light posts and sort of the sparks out here and the workers falling down, talking about, God, El Apagón, right? Which was blackout song that he was referring to. In terms of, hey, look, you know, since 2017, we've been dealing with this, and it was part of, you know, a generational neglect out here in terms of that. And it goes all the way out here to, I should have taken more photos, right? Debí tomar más fotos in that sense of remembering all the things and living in the moment out here. And that celebration of what it means to be Puerto Rican, but also what does it mean to be American within the context of the United States of America? And then you saw sort of the reaffirmation that America is a continent, is not a country, right? All the way from Chile, all the way from Canada, and all the flags that were provided out there, but with joy, with love, with celebration of the differences that make us great.
So you've been studying Puerto Rican movement to Central Florida for more than a decade now. Have you noticed any trends in that shift? Maybe increase in population or neighborhood presence or just even how people feel rooted here?
So that process of identifying, you know, what does it mean to be Puerto Rican in Florida is something that we're very interested in. But at the same time, you know, from studies out here of population movement, Puerto Ricans will follow economic opportunity. So there's always kind of like this circle migration out here, and they will look for places where they have jobs and opportunities. The theme park, the hospitality has been key in attracting a lot of Puerto Ricans to the area, but still we're forming those institutions, still we're forming those civic type of groups, trying to unite that political and social participation out here. which is very complicated because there's not a single Puerto Rican community. We have Puerto Rican communities, right? We have people that, you know, come from up north, of people that come from Chicago, people that have been here for a while, people that came before Hurricane Maria from Puerto Rico, people that came after Hurricane Maria, people that tried out here, went back, it didn't work out in Puerto Rico and came back to Florida. So it's a fascinating area of study in seeing how that has evolved out here in our community.
Do you see more of a Puerto Rican presence in everyday life in Central Florida today compared to 10 years ago?
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the arguments we made in something we published recently, when Hurricane Maria hit, and then all of a sudden, a lot of people started coming to, particularly Orlando, a lot of people realized, you know what? My neighbor is Puerto Rican. My doctor is Puerto Rican. My friend's kid's best friend is Puerto Rican. And all of a sudden, you get kind of like this reintroduction in a sense of, wow, there's a lot of Puerto Ricans here. And then you see it in kind of like the festivals that are out there, the restaurants that are out there, and sort of the presence out there. And even locally, right, we have a lot of political representation, you know, Maribel Cordero, Joanna Lopez, Amy Bonilla. I dare you and the listeners on your way home, see if you spot a Puerto Rican flag. It's like this little flag with a single star, a blue triangle, and red and white stripes, and see if you can spot a Puerto Rican on your way home.
So what's next in your research when you think about the future of the Puerto Rican community in Central Florida? What are you going to be watching?
You know, one of the big things that we're studying is, are people willing to go back to Puerto Rico? What have to be the conditions out there if they're willing to do so? So far, we find that they would like to emotionally go back, but the reality is the electric grid is not that great. Economic opportunity is not that great. But we're seeing that even within a decade after Hurricane Maria, we've seen that Florida has become increasingly more expensive. So we sort of starting to see, you know, we asked in our latest poll, you know, would you be willing to move out of Florida? And a high percentage of people said yes. We have been doing a series of polls in different themes exclusively for Puerto Ricans in Florida. We want to make sure that we identify those issues and we tell the decision makers, like, look, these are issues that is affecting our community. But so far, we've seen that a lot of the issues that we find that is affecting the Puerto Rican community are similar to the ones that are affecting the community as a whole. So that understanding not only helps Puerto Ricans, it helps us here in Central Florida.
Fernando Rivera is a professor of sociology and director of the Puerto Rico Research Hub at UCF. We asked you, our audience, for your thoughts, too. This is part of an email from Millie Ferrer-Chancy. Quote, I was super proud witnessing Bad Bunny give a spectacular performance at the halftime show. For one thing, it educated viewers in knowing that Puerto Rico is part of the United States, and Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens. As a Puerto Rican, I don't know how many times I have been asked if I am a U.S. citizen. Bad Bunny tried to showcase an island filled with various cultural customs like sugarcane fields, men playing dominoes, whole families going to parties bringing along their elders and children, as well as displaying many traditional treats. The last segment of his performance was my favorite, where he stated, God bless America, followed by a parade of flags from across North, Central, and South America. Thank you, Millie, for your email. The Puerto Rican Organization for the Performing Arts, based in Orlando, works to keep the island's culture alive in Central Florida. We're talking to Melanie Maldonado, the founding director of the nonprofit.
The traditional arts have been used to augment many elements of life, from traditional Christmas music to different kinds of protests and political campaigns. Traditional music in Puerto Rico really is part of the soundtrack of everyday life there in so many different ways. I'm thinking about commercial jingles to other kinds of consumer ways that people are engaged with traditional music through various forms of media. It's ever present. They're very knowledgeable about our traditional music. So coming to moving, just migrating over from Puerto Rico to Central Florida, engaging or being surrounded by or encountering traditional arts culture is very familiar. In terms of other consuming publics or other groups of people who encounter our music or have an opportunity to engage with our cultural traditions in one form or another, many of us who do this work engage in cultural education or arts education. Because it's part of our daily lives, we refer to it as cultural education, but certainly it falls within the broader realm of arts education as well. So we provide a lot of context, and that's why we're very much involved in humanities work. We engage scholars. We bring lots of context as part of what we do in terms of situating arts and other cultural practices within the framing of history and everyday life, not only for Puerto Ricans, but in a broader Caribbean context, in a broader context of the Americas and the African diaspora, et cetera.
This global spotlight that's on Puerto Rican culture right now, what happens when that fades and people move on? Where do you go from here with your organization?
Well, our organization has provided cultural programming for over 20 years. So we will continue the work that we are doing. Certainly, this global spotlight has heightened awareness about Puerto Rican culture and the possibilities for enjoying it, encountering it, engaging with it, learning more about it. What it does for us is provide a greater audience of interest, a greater possibility for support and engagement with a more generalized public.
Melanie Maldonado is a founding director of the Puerto Rican Organization for the Performing Arts in Orlando.
Por la mañana café, por la tarde ron, ya estamos en la calle, sal de tu balcón.
There's more ahead here on Engage, shifting gears to the Daytona 500 this weekend. From pit lane to the classroom, we'll see how Bethune-Cookman University and NASCAR are teaming up to fast-track students' careers. Subscribe to the Engage podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you don't miss an episode.
There's a lot going on in space, from efforts to land astronauts on the moon
and liftoff of Artemis 1
to answering the age-old question, are we alone in the universe?
Wouldn't you want to know if there was life on another planet?
Are We There Yet? Explores space exploration every Tuesday at 6:30 here on Central Florida Public Media.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. 200 years after writing her books, author Jane Austen still sparks passion today.
Her novels are the model of many modern stories today. Films. One of the common themes, for example, are a man and woman meet, they don't like each other, but through a series of events, at the end, they get married.
Coming up, we explore why and how her legacy lives on in Central Florida at the Jane Austen Festival this weekend in Mount Dora. First, more than 100,000 fans will be at the World Center of Racing for Sunday's sold-out Daytona 500. Just a couple of miles away from Daytona International Speedway, students at Bethune-Cookman University are revved up for the NASCAR Campus Lab program. Over 12 weeks, participants get a behind-the-scenes look at careers across the industry. They gain hands-on experience in marketing and budgeting, while also receiving resume and interview coaching. Bethune-Cookman University President Albert Mosley and instructor Dwayne Moore explain what this partnership between an HBCU and NASCAR means for students and the Central Florida community. First, you'll hear from BCU junior Michael Ogmala, who is a finance accounting major and a member of the 2025 cohort. What was your perception of NASCAR growing up?
My perception of NASCAR is just like cars running about, nothing really deep about it. But my cousin who lives in Chicago is like a big NASCAR fan because apparently NASCAR is big in Chicago. They have like the city drag race and stuff like that. So she tells me about the whole NASCAR thingy and I was just like, oh, maybe I should really look into it. Then boom, the opportunity to like join a cohort for like the Nazca Campus Lab came, and I got to know deeply about the whole program. But growing up, I wasn't really, really deep into NASCAR. I just knew it on the surface.
What made you say yes to this program?
So what made me say yes to the program was when they had the whole campus activation event on campus back in fall 2024. And then I was a freshman. So I went to the quad to see how the whole activation went. And I saw some of my friends that I just newly made being like the cohort. So I asked two of them about how the whole program was. Then 2 weeks after, at the business professional seminar, we had people from NASCAR come to speak to us about the whole program and all career like in NASCAR and stuff like that. Then I was like, oh, this looks interesting. But I was a little skeptical in terms of like trying to apply because I was freshman at the time. And I felt like, oh, this program is for like juniors and like seniors and stuff like that. So I just applied and put in my resume and I made a video recording and I got into the program.
Dr. Mosley, NASCAR has not always been culturally associated with the Black communities. How significant is it for an HBCU to be directly connected to an industry that historically has not centered on the Black community?
It's absolutely transformational for NASCAR and for Bethune-Cookman University as well. I think one of the things that I am really impressed about with NASCAR is their proactive approach, knowing just sort of writ large that the audience for motorsports racing is changing as our society continues to evolve. So historically, as you indicated, this is a sport that attracted a very narrow and specific audience. But given the fact that our population is shifting rather dramatically here in the United States, I certainly applaud NASCAR for their forward-thinking approach and knowing that not only in terms of the racial and ethnic makeup, but also in terms of the age as well, the age of individuals who historically have enjoyed motorsports. And so we are about maybe 2 to 3 miles. Our campus is about 2 to 3 miles from the headquarters. And so it just made perfect sense for them to reach out to us. And it made even more sense for us to respond affirmatively to them, and so that our students like Michael and so many others can participate in this program.
Dwayne, I just noticed you were nodding in agreement.
Yeah, I just agree that NASCAR has done a really good job trying to reach out to not only the African-American HBCUs, but just the age group, as Dr. Mosley was saying, to expose them to NASCAR. And so they've done a really good job in doing that.
Question for you, Dwayne, and then Dr. Mosley. What message does this send to industries that may not traditionally recruit from HBCUs?
I think it says our students are not exposed to the sports industry as much. It's like basketball, football, and NASCAR is also sports. And I think it says, oh, here's another avenue that I might have, you know, I can go with. As being an African-American or a student of their age as well.
Dr. Mosley, same question to you. What message is sent to industries that don't traditionally recruit from HBCUs?
Again, NASCAR being very forward-thinking here, that there are a couple of other industries where students from HBCUs may not have been as attracted to. So, for example, the majority of students at most HBCUs tend to major quite a bit in social service disciplines. So education, political science, criminal justice, and maybe nursing on the more technical side. I think for some of the larger industries, especially high-tech industries, one of the messages that we're hoping they will get from NASCAR, and one of the messages we're hoping that we'll be able to offer to them as well, is that HBCUs are also places where we do have students studying computer engineering, cybersecurity, applied AI, all of those sort of more high-tech, high-demand disciplines. And again, hats off to NASCAR for really paving the way for other corporate entities here in the Central Florida market to sort of take note of what's up at Bethune-Cookman University in particular, but also at other HBCUs as well.
Michael, what do people say when you tell them that you're working with NASCAR?
Oh, they're going to be like, oh, I mean, that's really big. That's huge. Because Over the summer, I interned with Brown & Brown, and majority of my friends that I made at Brown & Brown, they were like, what are you doing after the internship ends? I'm like, oh, I'm going back to school to start like the program at NASCAR. And they're like, oh, that's really huge. And they're big NASCAR fans. And they're like, they would die to be in that position. So a lot of people get like surprised when I tell them that I've actually had the experience with NASCAR in the motorsport industry, met with different people in the industry, and they're just in awe.
Michael, I'm wondering, for fans that tune into the Daytona 500 this weekend, is there something that you will be looking at differently just because of what you've learned with your experience that maybe most fans wouldn't see?
That's a deep one. So during the whole program, we got to see the Coke Zero Sugar 400, where we saw the Xfinity race and we saw the Cup Series. And we got to like see deep into how the whole like technicals are, how the whole broadcasting is, how the whole thing is, how the cars are made, how the cars don't really have like headlights, just, you know, make the cars light sound and stuff like that. I think it's going to give me like a deeper insight into how the cars are actually moving, what's really going on in the heads of the drivers and the whole team, because they're like in right communication with their team and telling them, oh, you move this way, you move that way, you move this way, and all that. And how, like, you know, the pit stop crew like work together to like change the things and work really fast. I think I'm going to be like viewing those things like in deep insights. And before like the whole program, I didn't really know that you were meant to like choose a driver to like really root for. I just thought you just watching a bunch of cars just go around in circles and stuff like that. So moving on, I already know that I'm going to be picking someone that I'm like going to be rooting for. Then just wishing them like luck and like always rooting for them. That gives you like the spirit that raises your spirit. Like you're rooting for this person. You want the person to win. You're like going head to head with your friend who's rooting for another driver. So I feel like that's another thing that'll be a different perspective in which I'll be like looking at the Daytona 500 when it's coming.
So Dr. Mosley, listening to Michael talk, what does it mean for BCU students not just to be attending races, but potentially shaping the future?
It's a wonderful thing. Michael mentioned one of his other internship experiences. I had a chance to meet him actually at Brown & Brown this past summer. And the unique thing for us, and I think this is really where it matters most for our students. So in most of these industries, while NASCAR in particular, you know, we think it's racing, it's motorsports. But behind the scenes, there are so many other disciplines that are required. So there are HR professionals, there are finance professionals, you've got individuals who've got to do marketing and all of those sorts of things. And so there are just so many different avenues where our students have the potential to gain employment for the future. And what the Campus Labs program does in particular is that it gives our students the necessary experience and a window into what some of those opportunities may be. For example, when they do the activation here on campus, they'll bring a car and the car is parked in our quad and everybody sees the car and they all get excited about that. And I think that, you know, one of the things I like to remind our students is that while you may not participate directly in what's happening with the car, there are so many other components that make that possible. So they need people in their finance office, their payroll office. They need people in the HR office. They need people in the marketing and communications office. They need students in all of these different areas. And this just opens an entirely new and different window of opportunities for our students.
Dwayne, if a young Black student in Central Florida is watching the Daytona 500 this weekend and doesn't think motorsports is for them, what would you tell them?
What would I tell them? Watch our students' activation. If there's a link to our student activation for NASCAR, they will see real-world experience from students or young women and men that are their age. And I got to see these students start from the bottom all the way up to the activation, and it was very, very real-world experience for them. And our students are, you know, accounting majors, our business majors. They got concentrations in hospitality, different things. So I think watch our activation and they'll see NASCAR.
Albert Mosley is president of Bethune-Cookman University. Dwayne Moore is an instructor and corporate partnership coordinator. And Michael Ogmala is a junior at BCU and participant in the NASCAR Campus Lab program. Now, from the roaring engines of the Great American Race to a different gathering this weekend, one steeped in its own history and tradition. Jane Austen continues to captivate fans centuries later, and that passion is on display this weekend in Mount Dora. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media.
The Wrap is a podcast from Central Florida Public Media, curating the top Central Florida news stories and in-depth reporting each week. Join me, Brendan Byrne, as I bring you news headlines, deep reporting dives, and insightful conversations from the news team. A new episode of The Wrap every Friday morning. Get it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. The Regency period marks an era in British history that extends from the 1790s through the late 1830s, the reigns of the Georges, third and fourth. It was a time marked by refinement and culture, but also very distinct and unequal class divisions. These characteristics of the era are the hallmarks of the literature of Jane Austen, one of the period's most predominant authors. Novels like Sense and Sensibility, Pride and Prejudice, and Emma examine relationships in society, usually through the perspective of women constrained by the societal norms of the time. A celebration of Britain's Regency period will be on display beginning tomorrow as the 3-day Jane Austen Festival kicks off at various venues throughout downtown Mount Dora. In addition to discussions about the author's works and legacy, there will be events reflective of the period, a lawn bowling workshop, a perfume-making symposium, and 18th-century hairdo classes are all on the schedule. And of course, attendees are encouraged to dress to party like it's 1799, though Regency attire is not required. Mount Dora resident Margaret Anderson created the Jane Austen Festival and is the current president of the event. She spoke with Engage about the weekend and began the conversation by talking about her connection to Jane Austen.
My mother read various novels to my sister and I, usually a chapter a night, and she read a lot of Jane Austen to us. We were 8 and 10, I'm the oldest, and she was reading Sense and Sensibility and came upon the phrase, "I will be calm, I am mistress of myself." And I stopped her right there and said, "What does that mean?" And she said, "Well, you know, you are in charge of yourself. You're in charge of your emotions, whether it be anger or joy. You're in charge of ideas. You're in charge of yourself." And one night about 8 years ago, I had a dream about my mother. And I woke up, and I was thinking of that instance, and I thought, you know, I need to introduce people to my favorite author, Jane Austen. And so, with a few friends, and also with the help of the Mount Dora Community Trust, I had this concept about having a festival around Jane, bringing in some educated Jane Austen experts, having a Regency experience. Our tagline is a foot in the 21st century and a toe in the Regency era. We have a 3-day festival. It started out a 1-day festival, and then it was a 2-day festival. Now it's a 3-day festival. We have close to 400 people attending from all over the country.
This event isn't being held at a convention center. The Jane Austen Fest's really incorporated into the community of Mount Dora.
When I first started, I got a lot of feed in from council members and other people in the community that this is exactly what Mount Dora needs. We are known as a city of festivals, but sometimes closing down the streets and putting up tents and wanting people to come by and buy things is not my concept of a festival. And so we, for example, have a trivia hunt and we put questions in the shops downtown, which brings our people into the shops. Hopefully they'll buy something there and answer the questions. The questions could be something like, who is Jane's sister? And they fill in the blank and so on. And eventually, when it's all filled in, they'll put it in a box and we draw names and give prizes.
You also have scholarships for women. Can you talk to me about how those work and the opportunity there?
Absolutely. That's what we're all about, is scholarships for women. Our scholarships are for women who are going to study history, literature, writing, or fashion. We think Jane would have liked those four subjects. Last year, a wonderful young woman from the Clermont area won our scholarship, and she brought to me an impeccably made dress from the Regency era, a corset, and a bonnet, beautifully made, and then wrote a paper. And one of the things that she said in the paper was, I didn't put a zipper in the back because zippers weren't created yet. So we just thought, this is the scholarship winner. And she's going to school up in Tallahassee.
What would you tell someone who has never been to this festival to try and convince them to go?
I would first ask them if they know who Jane Austen is. When I first started this, I had someone from Mount Dora said, oh, what did she do in Mount Dora? And so I have to explain that she wrote these six novels at 41 years old with an ink pen, not on a computer or a typewriter, with ink pen. I think her stories, her novels, have something in them that no other author before her time did. And that was, they were about women, and these women say no. That was not heard of. Women didn't say no very often in history. And in her novels, she has the women saying no. I think her novels are the model of many modern stories today. Films. One of the common themes, for example, are a man and woman meet, they don't like each other, but through a series of events, at the end, they get married. So I think that her writing, her descriptions, her understanding of human beings is something that, I guess as a person who's interested in history, I find that very fascinating.
Margaret Anderson is president of the Mount Dora Jane Austen Festival, happening February 13th, 14th, and 15th. We'll have information and links on our website, cfpublic.org. That's all for today's edition of Engage. We need your help shaping the conversation for an upcoming episode. When you go grocery shopping now, what's harder to afford? Tell us about what you're buying less of or leaving on the shelf altogether. Send an email to engage@cfpublic.org or send us a talkback on the Central Florida Public Media app. I'm Sharon Stone. Thank you for the company. NPR News is next.